Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers episode number 50, X17. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/50. The show notes include links to related episodes, books we've mentioned in the podcast, and the papers that we discussed in this episode, so that you can read along. And now, Randy and Jim talk about X17. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Jim, this is an exciting episode for me because, you know, for the last, actually my entire lifetime, I've been looking forward to some kind of anomaly in the particle physics community, a credible anomaly of something new. And that's been a frustration, I think, for a lot of particle physicists, too, is most of the discoveries and work has only verified the standard model, and there hasn't been much work beyond the standard model. And here we have something new to talk about in particle physics, the X17 particle.
X17. Why is it called X17?
Well, they don't know really what the heck it is, other than they think it might be either something new happening in nuclear physics that we hadn't seen before, or it could be a new particle that they think could be a force carrier for a fifth force of nature. So the X, I think, means they don't know what it is, but the 17 refers to its mass energy. So they're seeing a signal at the 15 million electron volt range in a couple of experiments now. The first one back in 2016 with beryllium, and then this year, a paper undergoing peer review right now for a very similar finding with helium.
You know how those experiments work?
Well, the beryllium experiments, I believe they were firing a proton beam at a target of beryllium and exciting it, and the transition from the excited state down to the ground state, it might have been another excited state, come to think of it. Has been creating an emission of electron and positrons that have a divergence angle of like 140 degrees. And then they recently did a similar experiment with helium bombarding at targets. And when that goes down to the ground state, they've detected a similar signal in the 17 million electron volt range. I think a slightly smaller divergence angle of around 115 degrees.
Okay. And so what happens here is they have, let's say with beryllium, they had a lithium target, right? They hit it with a proton beam.
To turn it into beryllium.
And so that would turn it into beryllium in an excited state. And then a little bit later on, what they detect is what?
They're detecting a pair of particles, electrons and protons, or positrons. And I guess those decay off into kind of opposite directions.
And then you detect those, I guess, and you find out how much kinetic energy they have, and that tells you how much energy they have total.
Yeah, so they think that the electron-positron pairs are some kind of new particle.
So what you're saying is that when you have this excited beryllium state, it has to decay into something, and one of those decays is not. So I guess we should say it's an excited nuclear state of beryllium. What they suspect, I guess there's a reference to this that I didn't read, that somebody did go through and actually check, but even in the first paper, they said that this is not a possible nuclear decay. That is, you can't have the excited beryllium basically decay into this electron-positron pair.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's kind of shocking. There's been so many particle experiments for so long that the idea of finding something new that doesn't fit within the existing model, especially in atoms that are as well-known and well-tested as lithium and beryllium and helium, it just seems so improbable. So this one really came out of left field.
I'm not sure if it's completely out of left field. Let's see if I can find exactly when the previous studies were done. So he references a bunch of previous studies. He said, we reinvestigated the anomalies observed previously in the internal pair creation of isovector 17.6 mega electron volt and isoscalar 18.1 mega electron volt M1 transitions in beryllium. And those were done from like 1996 to 2004.
Was that by the same Hungarian team that did these experiments?
I think the person associated with that was De Boer, D-E-B-O-E-R. And so he'd actually looked at these previously.
Oh, I see.
There are a couple of other references. The 2004 one, I think, may be a theoretical paper that goes through a bunch of different things, because I saw it while I was making notes from one of these other papers about a bunch of different possibilities of something or other. So they already knew there was something that could have happened here.
Okay, I didn't hear about that.
But they didn't really have a strong enough signal. So they'd seen something that may have been a problem. They didn't know that it was a problem at that point. They didn't have the strong signal. The thing here is that with both of these signals, you have about a 7 standard deviation signal.
Yeah, it's a huge sigma.
Yeah, so one's like 6.8, one's 7.2. Both of them are well beyond the 5 sigma limit, and 5 sigma is already pretty stringent.
So there's definitely something going on, right?
There's something here. You don't know if it's definitely. I don't know how many experiments there are. 5 sigma, I'd have to look at it. It's got to be extremely small, right? And since you have two things that are both consistent with each other, it's almost certainly not.
You mean it's got to be a really small chance that it's a statistical anomaly.
That's right. You have two of these things that have these really small probabilities of being a false positive. It's almost certainly a real thing.
Yeah, and it seems like the experimental protocols were stringent enough, and they did get into some real detail about how they controlled for, you know, cosmic rays and other kinds of possible errors in the background, that it convinced Feng and a whole group of physicists from the physics department at UC Irvine and the University of Kentucky to write a theoretical paper about it. So the 2016 paper is called Observations of Anomalous Internal Pair Creation in Beryllium-8, a Possible Indication of a Light-Neutral Boson. And then later that year, Feng and his group published a paper that was a theoretical analysis of their findings called a Protophobic Fifth Force Interpretation of the Observed Anomaly in Beryllium-8 Nuclear Transitions. There's still the possibility that there could be something structurally, I guess, going on within nuclear physics that we've never seen before. That seems like a hard sell, but it's possible. Or an experimental, something that they've missed in the experimental setup, although now that they've done it in two different scenarios, it's kind of hard to imagine that unless they were using the exact same equipment, you know, that might have had some kind of error in the data. Or there's another particle going on. It seems like those are the only real three options that we've got.
I think the thing that people are looking at is that it should be a particle. Now, you chose to look at this protophobia paper. That's a good one. In the new evidence supporting the existence of the hypothetic X17 particle, hopefully they change that to hypothetical, they list like 5 groups, one group that had at least 2 different interpretations. One was this protophobic abelian vector gauge boson. One was a light pseudoscalar particle. There was an axion, so there's a possibility that it could be an axion. There was a light Z0 bosonic state, and maybe some beyond the standard model stuff, like a non-standard Higgs with extra Higgs bosons.
But it seemed like they constrained several of those, and so that in this paper they focused primarily on the vector boson interpretation, right?
Well, they did do a lot of constraints in this particular paper. I guess the first one is that they don't think it's a scalar because it violates parity conservation. They don't think it's a pseudoscalar. They don't think it's an axion because there are severe constraints on the axion. But somebody actually did sneak in there and try to find a possibility of a axion that would work. So that would be your pseudoscalar particle. For vectors, what you normally think of is a dark photon, I guess, which is, you know, a photon that doesn't couple well to matter. But the couplings required are a bit too large for a dark photon, I think. But what they're saying is that some other vector gauge boson could do that as long as it has very weak and very specific coupling to matter. They also say that an axial vector is okay. An axial vector gauge boson would be okay, but that, you know, that was like one line, and I can't see anybody else doing anything with it. So possibly it's okay. And I think they threw out the graviton possibly as well, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but I was intrigued because they seem to have parameterized the charges. They looked at all the different kinds of charges that a particle can have. It looks like all of them are extremely small for if it's going to conform to this particle.
Yeah, so they were sort of looking at this in terms of the coupling to different quarks. So they said, okay, for the up quark, you know, we have some sort of coupling. For the down quark, we have some sort of coupling. And although we haven't tested these directly to figure out what the limits are. There was an experiment, I think it was what, NA48/2, that was looking for evidence of the dark photon. That was looking for a coupling to an electron, which still ends up being important here. And they used that coupling for the electron and, you know, some theoretical arguments about what would have to happen here to give some idea about what the coupling to the U and the D, or the up and the down particles, would have to be in order for the protophobic abelian vector boson to be viable. Basically, this means that this vector boson, this X17, would have to couple to the neutron 10 times more strongly than the proton.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. The idea that it couples more strongly to neutrons and electrons than protons, that's kind of baffling. You know, if you'd figure if it was going to couple to the electron, then it would have something to do with its electrical charge, and you'd expect it to have, you know, a similar strength reaction with the proton. But apparently there's a suppression of all interactions with protons that they don't understand.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they don't really understand why. And so I'm not really sure about that. I mean, I guess it's not too much less, right? So, yeah, the coupling to the proton, they say here, would be 8 times 10 to the minus 4. And for the electron, it would be about 1.4 times 10 to the minus 3. It's not really even an order of magnitude. It's almost not even a factor of 2. So it's about the same coupling order.
Yeah, but what could produce it, you know? I'd love to see some theoretical analysis to try to figure that out, because that would help us maybe understand something about the possible fifth force properties, you know?
Yeah, that's the idea, is that, you know, they're trying to get there. But first they have to get to the point where they agree on what the fifth force is, right? So, well, I mean, I guess they can keep investigating it as long as it's an open question. But as long as there are at least 5 different viable possibilities, just because that's all the ones that have been listed here doesn't mean that they're the only possible ones. In fact, there were another 4 or 5 that they mentioned in the original paper that I don't know why they might not work anymore. If there are 4 or 5 possibilities, and, you know, there are how many people that are actually working on this, and they're dividing up between 4 or 5 different possibilities, you know, it could be a very long time. I mean, how long has the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon been a problem?
I don't know. I didn't look to see when that was. It the G2 magnetic anomaly for the muon?
Oh, well, it's G-2 magnetic anomaly, yeah. And that's because it should have magnetic moment of 2, but because of renormalization, that G value should be 2, but it's a little bit different, right? And that ratio, that anomaly for the electron, is that super precise number that everybody likes to talk about in quantum electrodynamics, that it predicts to at least 10 or 12 decimal places. Who knows what it is now? It might be 17, right? I have a lot of faith in experimental physicists. So, you know, they get that perfectly right with the electron, and then they have a problem with the muon, and now they're trying to explain it.
Do you know how long they've had that problem? I mean, it's been a few decades at least, right?
I think it's probably been 50 years. Let me see. Did I bring that book in here with me? I did not. So there's a reference here for a book called The Rise and Fall of the Fifth Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about picking up for quite a while. I saw the reference in one of these papers, and I said, okay, well, I better pick it up now. But I like books like that. And I think, even before they tried to explain whatever anomaly with hyperphotons, the first attempt to explain this G-2 for the muon came from hyperphotons. So, yeah, I think it's been at least since the 60s, since the early 60s.
What are hyperphotons? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, they didn't work.
Mm.
I'm not sure when they decided they had the problem with it, but they started measuring it in 1961, the G-2 for the muon.
This X boson, if that's what it is, in the second paper they talk about how the range and the speed. They gave it a characteristic range of 12 femtometers, and a proton diameter is like 1.75 femtometers. So it's several times longer than the width of a proton, and they said the characteristic velocity was like 0.35C. I haven't done the math to try to figure out what time interval that exists in, but it's going to be incredibly small, which is a problem because I'd love to see how it would interact with other kinds of particles and, you know, nuclei and so forth. But
with that incredibly vanishing time frame, it's going to be hard to imagine that they could create that particle and get it to interact in a way that they could detect what those interactions are like, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So they're still thinking about, you know, how to confirm this or to figure out what kind of beastie it is. And in the 2019 paper, which is probably a 2020 paper since it hasn't been published yet, you know, they gave five different possible experiments that are either running now or will start in the next 5 years that will do something that might look at it towards the vector gauge boson, like the dark light experiment, which is a search for dark photons, but it's in the right energy range. And to other things like testing whether or not it's a Z-naught particle, resonant production through high energy proton beams, and stuff like that. So there are lots of different ways that they're going to look for it.
There's a collaboration named NA64, which is looking for it. And I think so far they've only been able to rule out certain parameters, and they're upgrading now to do another round of searches. Is NA64 a Large Hadron Collider team, do you know?
I didn't write that down. I think it is a CERN one.
Mm.
I'm not sure if it's an LHC. There was one that was an LHC and one that they just said was CERN.
Mm-hmm. And there was one that looked really promising that they won't have the results until 2023, I think.
Yeah, that was Phaser. I think that one is the LHC one, but I'm trying to look it up right now.
Well, that's exciting because a replication would make a huge difference here. You know, having one team reporting these results is problematic.
Yeah, the Phaser, the forward search experiment, where they just randomly picked out letters to make it Phaser.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
You know, it has to have a pronounceable name. Otherwise, you're not going to get funding. So, yeah, that one's at the LHC. And that one's been approved and is ready to go in 2023. The NA64 is at CERN, but it doesn't say here that it's at the LHC.
Well, you don't need that kind of collider to do this kind of research. That's one of the really interesting things about it, right?
Yeah.
It seems like a fairly modest requirements. You know, that's what kind of baffles me. I'm really glad this work is getting some attention in the popular press, because here we are spending, you know, billions of dollars on a huge collider like the Large Hadron Collider, and we have, you know, the best particle physicists in the world, most of them anyway, working there to try to find particles and phenomena beyond the standard model. And here's this fairly modest experiment that seems to have something that's worth looking into. I'm really hoping that, you know, somebody at a university will be like, you know what, we could set this up and verify this, you know, without too much trouble, or not, you know, disconfirm it. Either way, it would be hugely helpful for science.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, if they can find things at this level, I mean, that's good, right? So, in fact, you know, the more things you can find for cheaper, the better.
I guess they didn't really talk about what the properties of this fifth force could be, though. They seemed like they've tentatively connected it to dark matter. But I didn't really get a clear sense, even in the theoretical paper, for what this fifth force could be all about.
I mean, I don't think they know what it's about, other than there'd be another vector gauge boson. There'd be another field out there.
But they did all that parameterization on constraining its properties. Couldn't that give you some clues about what that field might be like?
Well, it might. I mean, it would be a lot like having a very weak sort of anti-electric field that does sort of the opposite, as best I can tell by looking at this, right? So, So like we said, you know, the electric field loves protons, doesn't like neutrons, right? So you might call it protophilic. It's a protophile. But this force is just the opposite. It likes neutrons, but it doesn't like protons. So it's a protophobe. So that's basically all they can say. It's quite weak. It's at least 1,000 times weaker than the electric field. But that's all you can say right now. I guess it has a mass. So you know that it has, you know, some sort of scale.
It has some sort of a range.
But given the short lifetime and pathway of this particle, does that constrain any possible long-range effects? Like, could this help us get a handle on, I mean, hypothetically, any of the kind of cosmological interactions like dark matter and dark energy?
Well, what I was trying to say was that because it has to have this limited range, because it has a mass, it has some sort of decay time. And so because of that, that's what makes it so nice for something like dark matter, is that you have this thing with a mass. It disappears before you can see it. That's something that a dark matter would do. And then it does another thing we like about dark matter is we don't want it to really interact with the rest of the matter except gravitationally, right? Well, one, it's very, very weak. It has this 10 to the minus 3 coupling to the up and the down quarks. And on top of that, on top of being weak, it doesn't like protons, which means it doesn't like the majority of the matter in the universe, which is just, you know, hydrogen.
I guess there's a lot of just protons out there in the interstellar and intergalactic medium, right? Because it's a tenuous plasma, right?
Yeah, so isn't it mostly hydrogen, like 90%?
Yeah, but aren't there also a lot of free protons and electrons floating around out there? I think they usually talk about it as a plasma state when they're talking about the medium out there. But if this particle decays into a positron and electron, then shouldn't we see gamma signatures from positron and electron annihilation out there? I'm thinking we'd have to see a lot of that for it to account for the dark matter observations, right?
I mean, but they'd be pretty diffuse still, right?
Okay, yeah. I wonder if, you know, I remember looking at the dark matter curves and everything and thinking that maybe you could actually explain the galactic rotation curves if there was a some kind of repulsive interaction at the outsides of galaxies pushing in, because there's a very small acceleration towards the center of galaxies and galaxy clusters that accounts for that flat rotation curve. So if there was some kind of repulsive force out there pressing on the galaxies, maybe this could explain it, because you'd have all those hydrogen atoms out there.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is another thing to say about this, is that, you know, the numbers I've been quoting have been absolute values. So the actual constraints are, you know, between minus something and plus something. They could very well do the exact opposite of the electric field. You know, where you'd have something that you think should be attractive, it's repulsive.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Yeah, I remember I was looking, I did a quick search. There was some talk about the X-17 on a Wikipedia page, and apparently there's a pair of particles, which they, you know, hypothetical particles that they also dubbed X and Y particles, that appear to be related to a form of unified field theory that wrongly predicted a higher frequency of proton decay than we've observed experimentally. But there's been attempts to extend that theory to explain that. And in that theory, you have a baryon number violation. That's really interesting. So, you know, because the baryogenesis problem, you know, is one that still remains unsolved. They're looking for a mechanism for that. And it would just open up all kinds of new possibilities if you could violate baryon number, you know?
Yeah, possibly. But I think we briefly touched on this before the podcast, is that I don't think these are the same things. But, I mean, they may be, but I don't think they're the same things. I think X just means they don't know.
Well, yeah, if there is a fifth force, then we're looking at a shift in the architecture of, you know, our entire model of particle physics, really. I mean, there'd have to be an additional architecture that we'd never seen before. So it might point in that direction or other directions that we hadn't even considered yet.
I mean, the reason why there's all this beyond the standard model in the first place is because there are just enough anomalies that you'd think that there should be something else out there that we haven't accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There are these anomalies that are decays of the B mesons. So those decays are a little bit off. We've got the G minus two that's a little bit off. You have the strong CP problem in QCD. You've got plenty of little problems. And one way to solve those little problems is new particles.
You know, that might be a fun topic for a show, is to just inventory all of the anomalies that we've seen with the standard model so far.
Yes, it would. There's probably a good review paper out there. This is not a review, but one of the papers that, or the 2020 paper, the one that isn't quite out yet, the new evidence paper, he had a reference to something called resolving the G minus 2 mu and B anomalies with leptoquarks and a dark Higgs boson. And that was by Dada, who's a name I'm familiar with, although I don't really remember where. I know the name. That particular paper probably has references that would help us find the best reviews for that sort of thing.
All right, that'd be fun. One of the things that I found impressive about this new paper, I think this is the first time we've ever discussed a paper which hadn't already passed through peer review, but it seemed to be very credible to other people in the field. Didn't seem like a big stretch to take a look at this one, too. I was impressed by the agreement in the mass between the beryllium and the helium experiments. I mean, it was just within really a fraction of a millionth of an electron volt, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for the beryllium, for the paper that we looked at, it was 16.7 plus or minus 0.85 mega electron volts.
I'm glad you had that handy.
But before doing this second paper we're looking at, which is the helium one, they refined those measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd gotten that to 17.01 plus or minus 0.16 mega electron volts. And then after refining those measurements, mostly just repeating the measurement to make sure they saw it twice, right? Because, you know, these are fairly long experiments, like year-long experiments to do. So, you know, you don't just run down to the lab and have data by lunchtime. That's what I used to do. So if I had the samples, if I had to make samples, it took longer. For the helium experiment, they came later. Then they have the 16.84 plus or minus 0.36 mega electron volts. So those first two look really, really close, you know, like 0.15 difference, 0.15 mega electron volt differences. But one, you have to look at that error, plus you have to look at the fact that when they found the better experiment with the beryllium, it was a little bit higher. But still, everything's within error.
Yeah, and there's a little overlap there, so it very well could be the same particle they're seeing there.
Probably is. I mean, at this point, it probably is the same particle because of the overlaps.
And it's hard to imagine that they're seeing a structural, something in nuclear physics happening, because you'd think that it would happen at very different energies for hydrogen or beryllium, you know?
Well, helium or beryllium, yeah. Yeah, probably wouldn't be that, but apparently they already ruled that out through theoretical means. I mean, they've been looking at beryllium for a very long time. You know, you can look at any possible transition and say, well, there's no way to get there from here. We've got a really, really nice list of beryllium states out there. So we know what all the transitions are.
Yeah, and helium too. I mean, Jesus, we've been looking at these things since the dawn of quantum physics.
Yeah, helium as well, but nobody's gone through and done the analysis yet.
Right.
Except possibly you.
No.
but somebody did the analysis of the nuclear transitions themselves.
And that's where they ruled out that it couldn't be a structural thing.
Zhang and Miller, I think, is the correct one for that.
Okay.
Yeah, Zhang and Miller investigated the possibility to explain the anomaly within nuclear physics. They explored the nuclear transition from the nuclear transition form factor as a possible origin of the anomaly and find the required form factor to be unrealistic for the beryllium nucleus.
But it was Feng's group that did the theoretical analysis and did an excellent inventory of all the parameter space based on all of the different kinds of experiments that could be brought to bear on this energy range and these kind of transitions.
So they did a really focused job for that vector gauge boson. These other people did this stuff for the other.
Like the axion explanation, that kind of stuff, right?
That's right.
Hmm. Do you remember anything from their work, if they had any encouraging findings? Like, does it seem probable that it could be an axion or one of these axion-like particles?
I didn't read that one.
Fair enough.
So I don't know. And I'm biased against axions. They've been around for a while. People have been looking for them for a while. And, you know, they've already eliminated huge categories of axions. So at some point, they stopped being that interesting. But that's my own bias. Right. So people use them to explain just about anything. They originally proposed for the strong CP problem. Then they decide, okay, well, maybe this will be dark matter. Maybe this will be dark energy. We can explain inflation with it. We can explain wheat prices with it. I mean, it's used for everything these days. I'm not a big fan of the axions. So, you know, I'm a little more interested in some of these other guys. You know, when they're looking at, like, one of the original paper's possibilities was a dark Z particle, right? A dark Z boson, whatever that would mean. It could mean the same thing as the vector gauge boson we're talking about, the protophobic. Because dark only means that, you know, you can't see it. So I'm not completely sure how these are related to each other, right? Because some of the possibilities in the two different experimental papers that the guy mentions are extremely similar, but they look just different enough that they really could be completely different things. But I don't know enough about any of them. One of those is this could be the light mediator for the WIMP particles, which nobody believes in this week, but they might believe in them again next week.
To my understanding, this most recent experiment properly, that checking my notes here, and I'm seeing that they were firing protons at a helium-3 target, and then that absorbs, I guess, a proton and create an excited state of helium-4.
If it was helium-3, it would have to...
I'm sorry, not helium, not helium, hydrogen-3.
So, yeah, so that's what they had to do. I think they had to trap that in a matrix of something else. Was it...
Titanium, I think.
Titanium?
TI is titanium, right?
Yeah, TI is titanium. So they trapped it in a titanium target. Probably, I guess, interstitially. Makes me wonder how they're actually doing this. So, not something that you're going to be able to do in your garage.
Right. That's a shame. I was kind of hoping we'd see a little reason for garage physics hobbyists to do some particle experiments.
I told you about that old Scientific American article.
Which one was that?
Build your own atom smasher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find a link to that that people can actually read, and hopefully we'll have 5,000-10,000 people building, you know, atom smashers in their garage.
That's such a great idea.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's wonderful. I mean, all you need is a motor, a couple of metal balls, some plastic tubes, and a giant elastic band, and you'll be good.
It'd probably be a good idea to have lead walls, though, huh?
Well, I mean, to be honest, that thing probably can't do anything really, really scary. Right, because, you know, you're using a spark from a Van de Graaff generator to power this. It's real mad scientist stuff, right? So you charge up this Van de Graaff generator, and then you get this visible spark between two metal globes, and that's what's going to provide all the energy for your atom-smashing experiment, right? I mean, it's awesome.
You're not creating a fountain of alpha particles, yeah.
I don't know how you're going to get your Jacob's ladder in there. You know, that's extra mad scientist research. You can send that to the mad scientist division at the NSF to get a grant proposal, because every mad scientist device needs a Jacob's ladder.
Yeah, or else it's just not that filmable.
That's right.
Well, all right. Was there anything else in there that grabbed your attention that you'd like to talk about?
I think we've hit the major points.
Yeah, they've got into a lot of really detailed experimental descriptions and how they've managed to filter out all the different noise and rule out all these different possibilities. They seem to do a great job at that, but it would just be torture to talk about, I think, because most people aren't, you know, including myself, aren't particle physics specialists and want to find it very interesting.
For these experimental papers, they are 90% description of the experiment, right? So unless you've been sitting around doing experimental nuclear physics for the past 6 years in graduate school, you might have a little bit of a problem trying to interpret what actually is going on. But that's okay. I mean, you can sit around and read it and see what they do. But most of the specifications here are for purposes of confidence, really. You know, you're just telling people, you know, we've done all of the right things. We've aligned all of the right devices. We've taken care of this problem that's shown up before. We've taken care of that problem that's shown up before, and so on, which is really important for an experimental paper. That's what most of the experimental papers is. And then you add a little bit of physics on the side. But the big point of the experimental paper is really just to say, in this case,
these results are valid, right?
Yeah, this is valid, and this is weird, and you better work on it, and somebody else better send me money. You know, that's the big deal there. So that's what I was worried about when you wanted to talk about this, is that I sort of had the feeling that this is what these papers would look like.
Yeah, really dry experimental modern particle physics stuff, which is, you know, really impenetrable.
Yeah, and no Jacob's ladders. They did not tell us where they put the Jacob's ladders. That's the whole thing that's holding this paper up in the review process is, you know, where does the mad scientist equipment actually go? That's why looking at this protophobic fifth force paper was so interesting. There is something in there that's telling you something about what it is that could be going on. It's not a lot, right? There's not a lot of data to go on, but it does tell you sort of where this would have to show up. And so I think that's pretty much what we wanted to look at. I mean, we spent most of our time talking about the protophobic fifth force, and that was really, really interesting. I think similarly, this data paper, and actually I didn't realize it until I just looked at this, and Jonathan Fung is also on that. So the Fung's the guy who did the fifth force thing, and he's also on this Alakpa data paper, who's at Ole Miss, so maybe that's why I know him. Yeah, so this particular paper was also interesting, but, you know, we can save that to whenever we want to actually talk about leptoquarks. So, and the dark Higgs boson instead of the light Higgs boson.
The dark Higgs boson.
Leptoquarks and a dark Higgs boson. Doesn't that sound conspiratorial?
It does if an alien particle.
Okay. So anyways, we could talk about something like that in the future. So we want to hit the weird anomalies. That would be fun. Like I said, I'm sure there's a giant review paper out there that everybody loves. I probably have the reference already written down, and I just didn't download it because, again, it's going to be a review paper that's 84 pages.
So we'll have to take our time on that one. Well, still.
Yeah, I don't know how long it'll be. Sometimes they're only 30 pages, but usually those review papers are really, really long, and they're hard to read because, you know, they'll make a sentence, and then they'll have six lines of references, and then they'll have another sentence.
Sure.
Maybe we can get the abridged version where they just, you know, leave out the references.
The Cliff Notes version.
Well, it's not even a Cliff Notes version. It's really just the prose, right?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
I mean, the reason why they do that is the reason why you read the review paper is to get all those references.
Stuff. That's right.
Yeah, but still, it makes it very, very difficult to read them sometimes.
Well, still, we love anomalies, and this was a good one. I'm glad that we found a nice, juicy particle physics anomaly. It's a hard beast to come by. And I'm really excited to see where this all heads. It's a shame that we might have to wait until 2023, another 3.5 years or something, to find out. But it's nice to see that so something on the horizon that we'll be able to look forward to talking about.
Don't feel too bad about it. I mean, you know, it's been like a month and a half since the second paper, the second experiment showed up on the archive. You know, and it was only about 2 or 3 weeks old. It was still getting press when you suggested it. But then it took us another 2 or 3 weeks to record it. And we've got another 2 episodes, I think, before I get to this. So
if you're hearing this, it's a 3-year wait, maybe, right?
Yeah, it's only 2 or 3 months, but it's not going to be the hot topic that it was, you know, when you suggested it, which is another reason why I don't like doing things that are hot topics. You know, I could expedite it, but this also makes a very, very good 50th episode, which is what this is going to be.
Cool. Well, happy 50th episode, Jim, and listeners.
Happy 50th episode. I'm glad we've had such a fun time doing this, and I hope everybody enjoys it very, very much.
And we do sometimes hear from aspiring mad scientists on Facebook. So, you know, all you mad scientists out there, I hope you get into some good weird physics and give us something to talk about in the years ahead.
Oh, yeah, that would be good. Did I tell you about my mad scientist account? I must have complained about it while I was in New Orleans because it sort of pissed me off. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm very, very sorry. You know, I'll cut out the paranoia and put it as an extra special thing for the people on Patreon.
The good stuff. You got to pay to get that.
All right. Thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, James. Always good talking with you.
It's been nice talking to you. We'll find out something great next time.
Sounds great.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, episode number 50, X17. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/50. Show notes include links to related episodes, books I mentioned, the podcast. I think I mentioned The Rise and Fall of the Fifth Force. There'll be an Amazon link to that if you'd like to purchase that. And the papers we discussed in this podcast. If you have any comments, that's a good place to leave comments. You can also go to our Facebook page, and we also have a Reddit page as well. Thank you. Bye now.